This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Perhaps you recognize the following stanza. The time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax, of cabbages and kings. It comes, of course, from a famous poem by Lewis Carroll. But to mix metaphors a bit, if we did travel through the looking glass to where walruses actually spoke, the many things they tell us might just provoke a much deeper understanding of Earth's environment. At least, that's the perspective of today's guests. Marine ecologist Carlton Ray has been studying animals of the Arctic for more than 50 years. His wife and research partner, Jerry McCormick Ray, for more than 30. And of all the creatures they've investigated, they believe what we can discover from the walrus may be most critical. So what the Rays have been learning from these two-ton Arctic dwellers will be our focus right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. Our focus today, walruses, and what they may have to tell us about the state of our planet. How much do you already know about the walrus? What would you like to know? Are there other creatures you think also have something to say about Earth's environment? 888-967-2825. Combined together, they've done more than 80 years of research on the animals of the Arctic and the near Arctic. It is a great pleasure to welcome back to the Insight Studios environmental scientist Jerry McCormick Ray, along with husband and research partner G. Carlton Ray. Thank you both so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, what is it that you most want people to know about the walrus?
Well, walruses are for us, a symbol, a canary in the coal mine, in a true sense, because the Arctic and the subarctic Bering Sea, where the walrus lives, are currently experiencing about twice the rate of climate change and sea ice loss as any other place on Earth. And walruses breed on sea ice, and if the ice disappears, well, there go the walruses. And a lot of things happen. One is the Eskimos don't have as many resources. The benthic system, the bottom of the Bering Sea, which Jerry will explain later, is affected. All sorts of things happen. And the walrus, they say, is a canary in the coal mine. There's lots else that lives up there. Polar bears are famous, many seals. Fishes could move in, expanded fisheries. And so we've got quite an issue on our hands, and use of one animal, the walrus, to explain or expound upon what's happening up there might catch the public's interest, and I hope it does.
Jerry McCormick Ray, canary in the coal mine?
Yeah, well, it's the canary. It tells us that they need to eat, and that's what we don't know a lot about, how the walruses make a living up there, because they are inhabiting that area in the coldest, darkest period of the season in December and January, and they're reproducing all alone with the other marine mammals and the Eskimos. And they're hard to observe, they're hard for us to know, and they have to make a living. They have to eat.
But there's something that you do in the decades of research that you've done, to a degree you've specialized in this, where you study a connection to how walruses are critically important to the rest of the health of the environment that they live in.
Well, they have to eat on the bottom. So they have to dive about 40, 60 meters in that deep ocean. And they have to find the resources to be able to consume that'll keep them going. And give them the milk to reproduce and to have their young. And that's one of the intriguing questions, is that how do you study these animals when it's very difficult, it's a very big ocean, and the animals are a very small part of this whole Bering Sea.
But from what I've read of your research, Jerry, one of the critical things that the walruses do is, in essence, dig up the ocean floor?
They have to go to the bottom, them all the way to the bottom, and they have to bioturbate, is what we call bioturbation. They're like a giant earthworm, and they stir up that bottom in order to get the clams and the other animals that they can find to eat on the bottom. And by doing that, they disturb that bottom and release a lot of nutrients, a lot of carbon, a lot of nitrogen that gets into the water column and goes up in the atmosphere some. But and that makes more opportunities for other food organisms to recolonize.
Now, I'd like to expand on that. I'll give it a little dimension. The total Bering Sea fishery is about 2.5 million metric tons a year. Now, walruses probably consume between 4 and 6 million metric tons. All of them together. Maybe 150,000, 200,000 of them. They eat a lot. And anything that takes out that much essentially changes the oceanic system. It's a bit like something on the top of the food chain eating all this stuff, which keeps other things on the food chain kind of the cap on it. So you lose walruses. If the sea ice disappears, you lose all that function. You may lose a lot of production. And this is no small matter in a sea where that we actually depend upon even today. You go to McDonald's and eat a fish stick, and that's comes to the Bering Sea. It's pollock from the Bering Sea. Largest commercial fishery, single species fishery in the world. Well, so things walruses do as part of a system, you add in all the other marine mammals, and the total consumption goes up to about 12 million metric tons. The total world production is 100 million metric tons. So we're not talking about something trivial. It's something large.
And walruses and seals both. You've studied seals as well.
Oh, yeah.
They both have this function of disturbing the ocean bottom in a way that's critically important to the health of the ocean?
No, some of the seals don't eat on the bottom. Gray whales do, bearded seals do, and walruses do. And the effect of that, disturbing that whole benthic system, the bottom of the ocean.
Tell me more about this idea of a benthic system. Benthos means floor, bottom?
The floor. Well, there's a layer on the bottom of sediment that animals can live in. And there are a lot of different kinds of these animals. Jerry studied these things in Icebreaker and so forth. And the rain of plankton in the ocean goes down to the bottom and is consumed by all these animals.
Benthic animals.
The plankton is the
small,
little, tiny baby plants.
They're not babies. They're tiny.
The tiny. And they live on the bottom of the sea ice?
Some of it starts are microalgae that live in the sea ice. And when the sea ice starts to melt, all that rains down and nobody eats it. Or a few species do, but a lot of that production in the sea ice, that's why sea ice is so important for the system, is that all of that production of algae, that primary producer, is settling to the bottom. And that gives the nourishment to the clams that are feeding on that rain of nutrients coming down from the sea ice.
It's a connection. Everything's connected, you know. So you get the ice, you get the plankton, you get the stuff falling on the bottom, you get the benthic animals, and clams, particularly for walruses, and then walruses come along and eat all that. Production goes back into the ocean, you know, and so you tease one part of that, and the whole system changes. It doesn't break down. I mean, it could break down and give us some things we don't want at all, runaway jellyfishes or whatever. This is complicated. Let me tell you one other thing about what it takes to study walruses. It takes icebreakers. The U.S. only has one operational icebreaker right now, so we actually have to rent some of them in certain cases to go other places. Other nations have many more. We're building one more, not enough. That's a national security issue, too. The Coast Guard owns the icebreakers, and they watch what's happening. It needs aircraft, and primarily it needs satellites, because we can look at the ice and see what's happening to it on only one way, and that's satellites. So this is expensive. And right now, our Congress is, much of it is not exactly friendly toward research. And we need satellites are becoming old, a lot of them, not being replaced.
The other aspect that we need, too, are people, the scientists. And National Science Foundation right now is being reviewed for their funding. And there's some talk that they may have their budget cut, and that will hurt a lot of the research up in the Bering Sea.
Well, I understand that there are many aspects to this, that both of you, in all these decades of research that you've done, have seen dramatic changes in the climate in the Arctic, and all of the different kinds of animals and different species that are affected, and that you see the walrus as being critical in a number of ways for what the future could be in Arctic regions. And I want to ask you about more on all of that and some of the policy changes that could be coming from the White House, one announced recently, some of the ones that you'd like to see. But since the two of you identify the walrus is so critically important, tell us a little bit more about these guys and gals. How many are there? Where are they located? What do they look like at different stages in their life cycle? How long do they live? How social are they? How smart are they? Anything and everything.
Okay, that's the fun part. Because both of us are delving into natural history. I remember the first time I went up there, sent by the New York Aquarium in 1958 to bring a baby walrus back to the aquarium. So I go out with the Eskimos. I come across sea ice, and all these walruses are going by in small groups, and they usually go by in the spring in a migration north in groups of anywhere between 4 or 5 and maybe a couple of hundred on ice floes. And you see there's babies among them and a few males, mostly females and young. And so the Eskimos live on these things, and so they go out hunting. Well, I had to go out hunting with them in order to get a baby, which I paid only $100 to the Eskimos not to shoot, because they also live on the babies too for meat, but mostly for rope. Young walrus skin is a very good rope. These animals are like cattle that we use, and for the same reason. So I keep
you
this
mean
baby,
to the native peoples in Alaska.
Yeah,
they use the Eskimo.
Yeah.
Sort of the way that the Spanish explorers used to use pigs. Everything
oh, yeah.
but the squeal.
Oh, sure.
They've got a purpose for every part of the Eskimo.
Every part,
that they
the bones,
kill and
it.
Harvest.
And so I collect.
So you're out there, 1958. Your mission is to bring back a baby seal to a zoo in New York.
Right.
And what happens next?
Well, they kill the females too, including females with calves. So I take a calf off the ice, and then I put the calf in the skin boat. It's a boat covered with
Can you
walrus
describe
skin.
What this walrus calf looked like?
Yeah, it's about 130 pounds, newly born, have a cute
That's
little
a big
muzzle
baby.
Covered with hair, no tusks yet, very smooth, almost silky to touch, and very, with hardly any handles. You know, trying to pick these things up is not easy.
So what you do, just sit them on your
no,
lap
I,
while
I,
they...
I picked them up and put them on my, and they crawled into my lap.
They're very wow. dependent at that time.
Yeah.
They need their mother.
Yeah, and I was it for a while. It was just love at first sight. I mean, they are very, very, they're puppy dogs. And then don't fool with a female walrus if you've got a pup. She'll come at you. And one of them did one time.
But what happened next is you gathered
well,
up
Well, I
this...
took it home and after several
How did
tries,
you take it home?
In an airplane?
You're in the middle of the Bering Sea. You get a baby walrus that weighs 130 pounds on your lap. And
yeah.
the Eskimos are, taking you back to shore. Then what happens?
Well, we got four of them, and some of them didn't make it. And then we finally discovered a recipe on which they could live. It's kind of expensive. Whipping cream mixed with clams or oysters, and that becomes their milk. It's 35% butter fat and a lot of protein, no sugar, and they just grow like crazy. Anyway, that's another story having to do with animals. Once you get them back home, of course, you're reminded very, very quickly of the value of animals that people can see and touch. It becomes a very important thing.
Marine scientist Carlton Ray and Jerry McCormick Ray are our guests. Primarily, we're looking at what they've found in their many decades of research on the walrus, but lots of other aspects of how the walrus has something to tell us about the world's environment. And we're going to continue this discussion in a bit more than 1 minute. Based on what our guests have been telling us, If you have ever eaten fish sticks or a fish sandwich, your meal may well have been made possible because of the work of walruses and what they do to contribute to the health of life in the Bering Sea. That's going to be a rather startling realization for some of us, but I wonder if you listening can offer some other insight into how we might be connected to other animals or plants in different parts of the world. Our insight line is open at 888-WMRA-TALK. Questions welcome to 888-967-2825. Jerry McCormick Ray is senior scientist in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia. Her husband and research partner, G. Carlton Ray, is a research professor in that same department at UVA. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So, Carlton, you were telling us about walruses in general. Answering some of the basic questions. How many are they? Where are they located? What do they look like at different stages of life? And how long do they live? How smart are they? How social are they?
Okay, one thing I'd like to just do a small correction, if you don't mind it. I didn't mean to say the fish sticks were due to anything to walruses. I was merely bringing that up to show the importance of this sea. Actually, walruses are north of where the pollock are, but that's another matter. What I would really like to go on with is how gregarious they are. Gregarious means animals all getting together. Bats, a lot of the antelope in Africa, caribou are gregarious. They travel in herds. And if you come across walruses, you may see groups of 200, 300, 400, 500 gathered in an area over maybe 20 kilometers, let's say 10 miles on a side. And this is one big herd. We've counted as many as 10,000 animals in that one herd. When they get underwater, they communicate through sound, which they do, food finding, social reproductive behavior by sound. And these huge groups in February gather to breed. The males fight with each other for territory, which is an acoustic territory, namely sound dominated. And then they travel from the Bering Sea up through the Bering Strait in May and reside at the Chukchi Sea in summer, except for the males.
Now, the Chukchi Sea,
that's up
if I'm pronouncing it correctly, is just north of the Bering Sea.
Exactly.
So that's kind of like the northern part of Alaska,
yeah.
The western
right.
coast of Alaska to the north is where the Chukchi Sea,
right.
Sea is. And then the Bering Strait is...
That's the connection.
Directly below the Chukchi Sea, and then, I love that name, and then the Bering Sea is the south
yeah.
and west of Alaska.
Right.
Okay.
Right. That's whole area.
And walruses live in all this region.
All this region, and they communicate. Bering Sea in winter, Chukchi Sea in summer. Males go to land, and they diversify into various areas. But what I wanted to mention, some of their social behavior, they use their tusks not to dig clams. You can't dig underwater because you're weightless. So they plow the bottom with their muzzles, very much like pigs, and get propulsion from the rear flippers. That's the power. So the power drives them forward like a tractor, and they plow the bottom to dig for clams and so forth, which they can extract at the rate of about, they can shuck clams. They don't shuck them, really. They suck them out of their shells at about 60 about once every minute, like this, suck them up and eat about 60 pounds of these things, a big one, a day, something like 6% of their body weight. Now, sometimes they are not eating all the time. My migration, they're not.
Well, you were about to tell me something they did with their tusks. Did you say there was a social behavior they engaged
yeah.
with?
Oh, yeah, the social behavior. They have these big tusks. You'd have to, what they look like, you better just go to Google because it's hard to describe what a walrus looks like.
Oh, give it a shot.
Okay.
Paint me a picture.
All right.
Just with your voice.
A big tube, which is the body, about 2.5 feet in diameter, about 8 to 10 feet long. At the rear are two great big paddles called rear flippers. In the front are two short legs called, well, they're also flipper-like things. In the front is a rather small head. The eyes are to the side. The muzzle is short and covered with a big mustache, which they use for detecting clams. The tusks hang down. The males have tusks that can get up to 2.5 feet long. Females, almost as long, but not as heavy. And they use those for social interactions. They use them for defense. If a polar bear comes along, they can use those to drive the polar bear away. And if they're in the water, the polar bear is going to lose. On land, they may get a small walrus. That's about it. Otherwise, they're too big. They weigh up females about almost a ton and a half. The males up to 2.5 tons. So big, about the size of a Volkswagen, except of a different shape.
You know? Jerry McCormick Ray, what else should we know about what a walrus looks like, what its life is like, how it acts, how it behaves?
Well, they're very large. They're very rotund. As Carlton has always said, they look like a Volkswagen. So that's what they look like. And they're all huddled together. And the youngsters are huddled that need to be warm with their mother. And they can freeze. They can't go into water immediately. Otherwise, they can freeze to death. And so their warmth, the body warmth of the mother and the herd is important to them. And the walruses need to...
It seems to me that I've read that some of your research shows that they are remarkably social, and you think that they're remarkably intelligent.
I've never trained them. I would have loved to have trained walruses. When I was working with them, they weren't in captivity where I was in New York Aquarium. And so I never got to work with them. But working with other animals that are related to them and other trainers who have worked with walruses, they are smart. They are social, and I don't think we really have given them their due course in really understanding them. They're hard to hold. Since the Marine Mammal Protection Act protects these, they're hard to bring them into captivity. They're big. They require a lot of food.
Tell me more about their being social. Social in what kind of ways? Now your husband and your scientific research partner sitting there next to you, Carlton, has told us that they use their tusks for different social functions, but I'm not sure I understand what that means, let alone what else it means that they're social.
They need to be together. They aggregate, and they stay in groups. And putting them in isolation, like a lot of marine mammals, is detrimental because they need to be with other walruses. Social isolation is not a good thing for them. And they're socially interdependent. They communicate with each other. They feed together. When they are feeding together on the bottom, they signal each other in ways we can't begin to understand because we don't have enough research on it.
Let me break in on the tusk thing if I can. When you watch walruses on the ice, they have a social hierarchy. And the size of the tusk and the size of the animal determines where you stand on the social order, very much like many other animals, including people, the big guys, you know, they usually win. And what they'll do to avoid a fight is the two will come together and sort of rear up with each other and picture yourself with a walrus with his tusks up vertical. And they face each other with his tusks vertically. And the one guy will raise his tusk higher and he has bigger tusks, so they avoid a fight. He has to avoid fighting. Why fight if you don't have to? Every now and then, the smaller one may fight, and then it breaks out. And they can cause a lot of damage that way. So, they're very social, and they're very smart. You should Google YouTube and look up walrus, and there's one hilarious one where the trainer taught them to do sit-ups. Now, if you can imagine a walrus doing sit-ups, it's hilarious. But anyway, yeah, they're very social. And
Carlton, you've said in the past that while most people have heard about the plight of the polar bears, and especially how melting ice in the Arctic is affecting them, that the walrus is actually facing much bigger problems from climate change. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. The polar bear can breed on land. Now, we're talking of walruses of the Bering Sea now. Not all walruses are the same. In the Bering Sea, they breed on sea ice. If the sea ice disappears, they literally lose their breeding turf. Whether or not they would adopt land as a breeding site is an open question. They probably would. But right now, polar bears do come on land and can breed on land. Walruses right now do not. And so their plight is even more important. And frankly, because of their numbers, they far outnumber polar bears, at least less than they're over 100 someday. They, I think, are more important to the system in which they live because of the functions we've already described. They can change their system. I'm not sure that that's true of polar bears. I certainly wouldn't discount that. So they're pretty important, and they haven't received the attention they deserve, I think, from a conservation viewpoint. Now, you talked about all the other seals. There are four species of seals up there that use sea ice as breeding.
And when you say other seals, walruses are related to seals.
They're related.
They're called
other
pinnipeds?
Other pinnipeds.
Okay.
Thank you for the correction, yes. But they're related to seals, but there are four seals that are very abundant, too. The ring seal, ribbon seal, spotted seal, and bearded seal. And they are in the several million of them, perhaps. No one knows how many. You asked how many walruses there were. Well, they're almost impossible to count, as are many marine species, because the only way you can count them is when they're up in the ice. And all of them are never up in the ice.
And yet, there have been some reports that their numbers have declined significantly.
Yes.
That at one point, about, 10, 15 years ago, there were thought to be 200,000, and now it's down to around 150,000?
That's a pretty good guess, but we really don't know. Certainly they have declined for a number of reasons to say that. And right now, one of the big dangers is in the Chukchi Sea, the ice is literally disappearing in summer. So the walrus have to go to land, and that reduces their access to food because they don't swim that far.
I want to ask you something very specific about that in a moment, but I realize that there are people who have joined in who don't realize whose voices they're hearing. So let me mention that our guests are marine scientists Carlton Ray and Jerry McCormick Ray. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you'd like to speak with our guests, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. So the New York Times did a feature article on the plight of the walrus some time back, and I want to read to you both from near the end of this article. The quotes in this story are attributed to a Dr. J from the Alaska Science Center. So here the article says, adult male walruses leave the ice to summer along the coasts of Siberia and Alaska, but females and their young stay on the floes year-round. Over the past decade, the ice sheet has been retreating farther north each summer, so it ends up in waters too deep for walruses to forage. As a result, females and calves have been forced to abandon the ice in midsummer and follow the males to land. The voyage leaves them emaciated and easily panicked. With the slightest disturbance, the herd desperately heads back into the water, often trampling one another to death as they flee. The ones that take the brunt of it are the calves, Dr. Jay said. Our Russian colleagues have observed thousands of calves getting killed in these stampedes. You're nodding your head, Jerry.
Yes. Well, I only know what the news is reporting, but that's been reported several times, and that's a big impact on those walruses that have no place to go. They're trampling. It's what he's saying is correct.
Yeah. Keep in mind, that's just in the Chukchi Sea in summer. The ice... there's one mistake in that article, but that's not Dr. Jay's fault, and that is the ice moving north as a sheet. It doesn't move north as a sheet. It moves north as flows that are separated from one another. And the structure of that sea ice, all the flows, means the herds break up because they don't have a contiguous area to land, so they go on land. Now, that's a big problem. I would propose with several other co-authors were preparing a report on this, and with Jerry, who's one of the co-authors, the winter situation may be even more critical because that's where they breed. Not just feed, but breed. And when the ice is starting to break up there, their whole breeding pattern, the timing of breeding and so forth, and the migration when the pups may be forced to to go into the water to swim is all a huge cost. Now, the pups can swim almost from birth, but that's a bad deal for them. They lose a lot of energy. They want to stay on the ice with their mothers to feed on milk. And as if the ice disappears during migration, which it's doing right now, those calf mortality could be severe.
Dr. So, Carlton Ray, how much different is the level or amount of ice in the Arctic now than, say, 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, for the whole Arctic, it's been reduced, depending on the season you're talking about. In winter, it's been reduced only a little bit because it's still cold up there. But the ice is thinner. And the multi-year ice, the ice that persists over several years, is disappearing very fast. It's down about 90%. That's mostly in Canadian waters. The ice that lasts more than a summer and refreezes is going fast. The amount of ice, if you weigh it, you know, thickness times area, is down, oh, various estimates, by at least a half. In springtime and summer, it's reduced even more. In winter, the total area covered by ice is not that much reduced. It's a complex kind of thing. But when you combine the loss of sea ice and in any season, you have to think about it not as a sheet of ice, because that ice could be only a few inches thick, which is no good for walruses or seals. You have to get the thick stuff, the stuff that's 1 to 3 feet thick, that they can rest on without it breaking. So there's another thing that's happening up there. The less ice you have, the less reflection of sunlight you have, which melts more ice, and the more open water you have, the hotter it gets, which melts more ice. So there's a positive feedback between loss of ice and warming.
So it sounds like you can't put a specific percentage on it, but there's no doubt in your mind that over the past couple of decades, there's been a tremendous reduction in the amount of ice.
We can put a number on it. I just can't remember all the numbers right now, but some of the estimates go about half a million square kilometers in certain months and so forth. It is measured by satellites, the amount of ice. That depends on the satellite you're using. But the ice is reduced by at least half and probably more in summertime, and is due to disappear entirely in summer from the Arctic Ocean. We don't know when, but by 2050 or so.
Well, to you on the other side of your radio, if you're old enough, you may remember the famous anti-littering campaign of the early 1970s, where a Native American in American Indian garb was seen with tears in his eyes in response to the mess humans were making of the world. It was an exceptionally effective campaign for its time. So as we discuss the situation in the world environment today, Arctic and otherwise, I'm curious, might you have a suggestion for a type of message you think would get people caring more about our environment in today's times? Our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. You can also reach us through Facebook at WMRA's Virginia Insight. We've got more with environmental scientists Jerry McCormick Ray and Carlton Ray coming up in just a bit more than 1 minute. G. Carlton Ray has been researching animals in the Bering Sea and other areas near the Arctic since the late 1950s. His wife and fellow marine ecologist Jerry McCormick Ray has been studying that same region since the early 1980s. They are co-authors of the book Marine Conservation, Science, Policy, and Management. Both work in the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. If you want to speak to our guests, 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. In all numbers, 888-967-2825. Does it concern you that there seems to be a fair amount of debate on whether we should even be studying climate change in this country?
I think it's astonishing, frankly, because the science is in. There's no question in scientists' minds, the vast majority of climate scientists, to some 97%, agree that there's significant climate change. It's shown in the Arctic more than any other place, and that humans are responsible. Nothing like this. The rate of change, the loss of sea ice, the rate of heating of the oceans, nothing like this has been experienced at least in the last 2 or 3 million years, according to, and even farther back than that if you go to some other studies. So it's happening, it's real, and it's scary.
And the other evidence, too, of course, is the acidification is going on, which is really frightening.
Tell me what that means.
The oceans are becoming more acid. Usually, the oceans are very basic. And so this, from climate warming and a lot from CO2 that's entering the oceans, is making the oceans more acidic. And calcium carbonate is what a lot of animals use, the invertebrates, which are the clams and the animals that live on the bottom and live in the ocean and live in the water column, that are dependent upon. And if the acidity becomes too low, then they start to not develop shells. And these animals won't be able to reproduce. It'll completely change the whole system. And there's evidence of acidification on the northwestern coast of the U.S., and oysters that are in trouble, our production of oysters for commercial reasons are being affected.
And I may have mistracked there. Is this because there's too much acid in the water these days?
It is acidifying.
Well, it's really not. It's a reduction in pH. From pH 8.2 or 3 down to about pH 7 or...
I don't know.
It's a change in level of acidification.
Yes, that's right.
And you attribute that to warmer temperatures.
No.
It's to CO2.
CO2. Carbon dioxide.
Our emissions of CO2 that are contributing to global warming are also contributing to the acidification.
Right.
See, sometimes I have to ask really dumb questions so I can make sure I'm tracking. But people listening probably knew exactly what you were talking about. We're going next to Nelson County, Georgia. Thanks for calling in on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for marine scientist Carlton Ray and or Jerry McCormick Ray, please.
Yes, I would like to know whether there are walruses in the Antarctic area where the ice is increasing.
No such thing down there. Down there are lots of whales and, of course, lots of these pinnipeds we've been talking about. And it's
seals.
Seals, yeah. There are 4 species of seals, and including the big elephant seal, and 4 or 5 species of sea lions, like fur seals and things. No walruses. And one of the reasons for that is the Antarctic doesn't have much shallow water, which walruses require. There's so much ice in the Antarctic continent that it's pushed the continent down so that even very near shore, it's pretty deep.
But the Arctic isn't just increasing in sea ice. Some parts.
The Antarctic.
It's the, in the Antarctic, there is a huge area that is also losing sea ice at a tremendous amount. And so the Antarctic is not free of losing its sea ice.
Mm. Georgia, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to call us. I'm curious, how are warming temperatures affecting those native human populations in the Arctic regions that you, Carlton, had mentioned a little bit about before in terms of how much they depend on walruses for food and most everything else?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very interesting because if you're a hunter, you want to do what any other animal would do, and that is go for efficiency, go for the one that'll give you the most bang for the buck. And walruses are the one that they go for, Eskimos, the Yupiks, the Inupiat, and so forth, because if you compare them to birds, to get enough birds or bird eggs would take you all day and all night, all season long, to try to get enough to eat. If you go for whales, well, you can get 1 or 2 or 3, and You have to preserve all that meat, and you get a lot of prestige for getting one if you're a hunter. But that gives you these great big carcasses. Walruses are a neat package, and they're easy to kill. So they're big enough. They don't require a whole lot of technology. And a man can go out and kill a moderately sized walrus with a harpoon and a spear from a kayak. I've been on the ice near walruses. If you go downwind of them, I can get within, less than 6 feet from a walrus. I don't want to get any closer. But if you're behind a big chunk of ice and there's walrus on the other side and they can't smell you, piece of cake.
So the fact that the walrus populations are declining and their survival, at least in large numbers, is something of a question as the ice continues to melt. You think that the main impact on the native peoples of these region is that it's going to be harder for them to find adequate food as they hunt, as they try to replace walruses.
Oh, here as their you get to an source. Interesting social question, because right now the Eskimos, like all native peoples around the world, are changing very significantly. They have supermarkets. They have stores. Some of them eat vegetables like carrots and things, and some of them will eat hamburgers. So they don't depend on the walrus so much for food as they used to. Nevertheless, that's the least expensive large piece of provender that they can get. They also have a native industry of carving walrus tusks and that's legal. It's not legal for us non-Eskimos to do that. But when they kill an animal, they're required to keep and register the tusks and make some income that way. So they're affected in a different way than they used to be, from not total dependency on walruses and other living animals, but a lot of dependency, including psychologically. They lose some of their identity.
Their culture depends on it.
Yeah.
They identify, the young children are brought up with the image of being a great hunter to go out and capture a walrus. And that is being changed now to how do you make a living up there in the Arctic. And so it's a really tough culture that they're living under, and how they're going to survive and keep their culture going and keeping themselves going in an economy that they really just can't afford to live in.
Well, I understand that both of you are concerned about, I guess, what would be called increasing human activity in Arctic regions. What can you tell me about that?
Well, if you want to get to some of the world's richest oil and gas, that's where it is, a lot of it. There's a problem, and right now there's some exploration going on, but there's a restriction, and that is if the ice comes down on a oil well, you have a problem.
And but now, the fact that so much ice is melting, that what is there is
right.
often thinner, that it makes it much easier for exploration to take place and for greater numbers of human activities to be going on in areas where it couldn't before?
Right, fishing, tourism, all these things. And right now, we don't have any regulatory or enforcement. We have a few mechanisms. But we don't have really a very good way of facing law of the sea problems. The jurisdictions, who owns what out there in the territorial sea and in the international waters.
But I take it part of what you're concerned about is as oil and gas exploration, for example.
And fisheries.
Becomes more easy because of thinning or disappearing ice, think that can cause additional environmental problems.
And guess where a lot of the oil and gas comes from? In the Chukchi Sea is a place called Hannah Shoals. And that's been a traditional walrus feeding ground ever since there, I guess, have been walruses. And that's the primary place where the oil and gas is. So we have a direct conflict. Not that it can't be resolved, so far it hasn't been resolved. And President Obama has followed President Bush in trying to establish a national ocean policy. And John Kerry is much involved in this. There was a meeting just this week, ended yesterday, about a national ocean policy and marine reserves and things. And the stakes are very high, and they're all national security interests. National security for food, for fishing, for health, all kinds of things have come into this. So we just simply have to start paying attention to the Arctic a lot more than we have in the past.
Jerry McCormick Ray, I picked up a quote attributed to you in a news article from some time back, and here's what it said. The Bering Sea is like an untouched rainforest, one of the largest and most productive in the world, but we are seeing abrupt changes. The Bering Sea and neighboring areas now exhibit the fastest rate of change of anywhere on Earth. So first of all, Jerry, I'm curious, does that sound like you were quoted accurately?
Oh, I'm not sure if it's a direct quote, but it might. I would agree with it.
Okay, well, tell us more about the thoughts contained in that quote.
Well, that area is just changing so fast. And as I've said before, is that we don't have enough information to really know how fast it is changing or what it's changing to. We just know that there's a lot of indications out there that the Eskimos feel threatened. Sea level is rising on the coast. Walruses are losing their sea ice and moving to the coast to be able to haul out. There's a lot we don't know about it, and the other thing that's impacting the area, too, that it threatens not only the walruses and the Eskimos, is pollution. And even though this is a pristine area, the pollution it comes from and is falling into the oceans atmospherically is being absorbed in the food chain that eventually gets into the blubber of the walruses. And if the Eskimos eat too many marine mammals, they have high loads of contamination, which is another big threat. So there's a lot of changes that are going on in the Bering Sea, as well as the Arctic, that are not directly attributed to a particular problem, but it's
a global
problem.
And it seems to me that what I'm hearing from you is that your biggest objection is not enough research is being funded to answer key questions about this region.
There's so much that needs to be done, and it's a very difficult area to study. But the issue that people are looking at is the oil and gas issue.
And I need you to hold on that, because we have this one last call from Robert in Greene County. And Robert, if we can do it quickly, we can squeeze you in just before we have to close out the show.
All right. Yep. Thank you. Hello, Carlton and Jerry. It's Robert from the pitcher plant Bogs of Greene County. I have two quick questions. One, how long can a walrus stay underwater? And two, do they play games with their metabolism to slow their heart rate and things down? Because it's hard to imagine something so big living off of just clams.
Oh, no, clams are very, very nutritious, particularly if you're a walrus. They're mostly water, of course, but they get a lot of protein. They dive about 20 minutes usually. They probably could stay under longer. As for metabolic...
These are mammals that stay underwater for 20 minutes
at
a time?
Oh, yeah, but sperm whales and elephant seals and some others stay underwater for more than an hour.
Wow.
So walruses are pretty good swimmers, but they're not long-distance swimmers and they're not deep divers.
And you said earlier in the hour that they eat about 6% of their body weight a day?
Yes, when they're feeding. Now, they don't feed all year round.
But that's like 60 pounds of clams a day, you said.
Yeah.
That's a lot of clams.
A lot of clams.
Wow. Robert, did we get your questions answered?
Yeah, except for the metabolism. Do they have a fairly consistent metabolism?
No, or do they go into a torpor or something? Yeah, most marine mammals, when they breed, they shut their blood supply down except for the heart and brain.
Wow.
Yeah, they do that. And walruses probably do the same thing. It's, to my knowledge, it's not been investigated. You know, Jerry?
No, it's the CO2 tolerance, and it's different than ours,
yeah,
that they can tolerate higher loads of CO2. I think that's right.
Robert, great questions. Thanks so much for joining us. Jerry McCormick Ray, we've got 30 seconds left if you want to say something else about your pitch for better research.
We need more research, because that area is just not being studied. The benthic area, the bottom of the Bering Sea, that is cold, it's hard to get to. The research is... what we really need to understand is the system, how the Bering Sea system interacts, interrelated, how the walruses and the benthos, the shellfish, the Eskimos, the climate change, all of that is interconnected. It's all moving very quickly, and we need to study the Bering Sea as a whole system.
And there's no doubt in your mind that it has been changing dramatically, and those dramatic changes have been happening quickly.
In
you
ways
just want
we
us to better understand it. Our guests have been Jerry McCormick Ray and G. Carlton Ray, both marine ecologists, both members of the Department of Environmental Sciences at the University of Virginia, and together co-authors of the book Marine Conservation, Science, Policy, and Management. Thank you both so very much for making time for us.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
Podcasts of this program are available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. And when you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will find links to more information about our guests. Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Associate producers, Bob Levicky, Terry Ward, and Dan Easley. Some of our break music, supplied by Robert Chespay and...